Hey, welcome to another edition of the Moviegoers. I'm Phil. I'm with the regular guys tonight. Andy.
Hello, this is Andy.
And Greg.
Hello, this is Greg.
Tonight, we're going to be starting off with Cloud Atlas. Cloud Atlas is a return for the brother-sister combination of Andy and Lana Wachowski, who did the Matrix movies, and there's actually a third director with Cloud Atlas, Tom Twyker, who did Run Lola Run. So unusual to have multiple directors on this. And I have not read the book, but it was a bestseller, and Cloud Atlas has Tom Hanks, Halle Berry, Jim Broadbent, Hugh Grant, and it's rather large story, or maybe six stories all in one, spanning the past, present, and future with overlapping themes and characters. I guess let's just start off real easily. Andy, what'd you think of the movie?
I like this movie a lot, you know, just to give a general like, and I almost, a lot of it for me is just going to come down to, I just kind of, a little bit of respect of taking the, you know, for the filmmakers to take this movie on and just sort of say, yeah, we're going to try to make this movie.
Greg, like, dislike?
If you're putting it as just pure like, dislike, right now I'm going to have to say dislike. Right after I saw it, I was like enjoying the movie while I watched it and was sort of with it. And then it's been a while since I saw it, and I almost haven't thought about it very much since then, and sort of lowered in my estimation, even though, although I do agree with what Andy said, that it's kind of cool that they tried this, but ultimately it's
Part of the reason I think we all saw this movie was because of
Did you like, dislike it? You have to frame it.
I was trying to hold off on that because I guess, yeah, like or dislike, I guess disliked, but along the lines of you, I can see it was all right when I was sitting in the theater. Some of the stories, since it is almost short, six short films in one,
yeah,
worked better for me than others. I mean, I think like my expectations for it were a little bit different than what the movie ended up being for me. So maybe that's partly it. I thought we were in for kind of like a really wild, bizarre ride.
Mm-hmm.
And more and more it felt like all the stories I had experienced before, and except for some moments, I didn't find it that surprising, and it just became riding along the same themes. In six different stories, they were all about the same theme, and oh, it's this grand movie. And I kind of admired the scope, and there was definitely passion behind it. It felt like an overly long, huge melodrama.
Well, what would you say the themes are?
Soulmates. The belief in soulmates, like true love, like they're kind of,
well, a lot of it is, really. You know, I think, well, it's got to be people escaping bondage.
Yes.
You know, is probably, I mean, I can think of three or four.
Yeah, there's definitely an oppressor.
But did you find the themes sort of lackadaisical in just that they went along, or did you find their like visual representation, you know, was it just repeating, it felt like each story was repeating the same notes with, yeah, the characters, or like what?
But yeah. I felt that was intentional. It wasn't I just didn't think it was that deep for as huge of a movie.
Right. No, I think that's part of the problem.
It played broad emotion.
Yeah, it does. The movie feels like it is going for deep emotion. And I wouldn't say I had a deep emotional response to it, but I liked and enjoyed, you know, watching it play out a great deal. And
yeah.
So there were certain, you know, of the storylines that I got much more invested in.
Which ones were those?
Yeah,
oh, the... the incredible ordeal of Timothy Cavendish.
That's the Jim Broadbent one.
It was my favorite. Yeah, it was my favorite, and it was kind of odd because it's maybe the most plain of them in a movie that's pretty stylish and like very, you know, period flourishes. It was the one that just had this mix of tone. Yeah. And I shouldn't say it wasn't stylish because the filmmaking in it, I think, is very a lot of style, a lot of interesting stuff going on. I loved that Jim Broadbent and kind of everything that happened in that story. So
yeah, for me, that as well had the most sort of fresh feel to it, where it was this mix of comedy and bizarre, and his performance.
When you think about that, it starts out with Tom Hanks throwing somebody over the roof.
Because that's what I wanted throughout the movie was Tom Hanks in bizarre outfit and bonkers. Yeah. And it hits that. And I'd forgotten, because I was going to bring up Tom Hanks in that role. He plays sort of this
London thug
and out of control. And it's beyond camp. It's something else. And then it leads into the Jim Broadbent story where he gets put into an old folks home. But his performance in that is so much fun compared to some of the other performances.
And then I really love the reference later when we're in the future and, you know, Jim Broadbent has written his memoir of this experience and then it gets turned into a movie that a new Tom Hanks character is starring in. And like, you know, the Korean replicant woman in the future is watching it, and it's called The Incredible Ordeal of Timothy Cavendish. And like that tie-in to me, which, you know, obviously comes from the book, but just what the book, you know, couldn't get is that Tom Hanks is now starring in it. You know, not I haven't read the book. I'm really interested to kind of pick through even just the start of the book to see how it plays out. But yeah, how did you guys, you know, I don't know, like,
because at the same time, so I like that Jim Broadbent story the most, and like the opposite of that, I found the slave trade pirate ship to be by far the least successful out of all of them, and it just as a story in itself, it was the one that the movie is not dull, but if there was a dullness to it, if it was for me, that storyline. And the movie's edited, I think, really well, getting a consistency through all six stories. But
yeah, I wasn't bored watching the movie at all. Right. I wasn't like, could this end or anything like that. And like, I was interested where things were going, and I thought the filmmaking was pretty good. I mean, I was surprised at like some of the stuff, but I think at the end I felt like I was searching for the themes, and I was kind of like, what are the themes here? And I was like, basically this is like a movie that's like,
I feel like it was talking about its themes pretty
they have narration.
I know, but it was like, be good, you know, it's like good versus evil, don't enslave people and fight for freedom. And I'm like, I've seen a lot of movies deal with these themes, and just The Matrix deals with the same theme, but much more elegantly within the story, and just is much a better expression of that.
Right. I ended up watching The Matrix immediately after coming out of Cloud Atlas. I was going to talk about it later, but I mean, that is really...
Yeah.
It not only holds up, it is brilliant. It is, and they are talking about the same.
Oh yeah, have you guys seen Speed Racer? Because I haven't.
I've seen
a decent amount of it. You know, I mean, literally like HBO watching. You know, when it would come on when it came out, and no, I couldn't make it through that much of it. But like in bits and pieces, I saw it, and I wouldn't recommend. From what I saw, I wouldn't recommend it to anybody.
I was curious though, because when I was watching the movie, I was trying to think of like the cinematic influences for this movie, and I was thinking their own movies.
Right.
I thought literally they were like sort of influenced by themselves, which I actually thought was an interesting.
Well, But you could say the new, you know, new soul is obviously, it feels like a Matrix, you know, like a post-Matrix movie. But what else of their filmmaking, you know, because there's a lot more filmmaking.
Well, visually speaking, the futuristic stuff I thought looked like Speed Racer.
Right.
But
what about, like, for instance, the slave ship Pacific Islands? Like, did that feel... And I don't know whether the Tom Kreiker or the Wachowskis directed
that.
Yeah,
I don't know who directed what.
But did that feel like a Wachowski, you know...
The slave ship one?
Or even the cannibalistic future, you know.
Yeah, all the cannibalistic future stuff felt like a mix of sort of the Matrix with, like, there was sort of some underground, you know, revolution against, right, you know, the, you know, oppressive future.
Yeah.
And the sort of visuals of the landscape and stuff I thought looked like Speed Racer.
Yeah.
And then they had that they had Morpheus in that storyline. There was some, you know, guy who was like the leader of the rebellion or something.
And Keith David,
yeah. I mean, it was
I do think, because I actually, when I think about their filmmaking, like, I really, you kind of, the Matrix is so unto itself and gets a little overshadowed by the like special effects stuff in it, I think, sometimes, and like the, you know, the Neo Soul. But if you look at Bound, I really think a lot of the filmmaking is in line kind of with, like, what these guys are interested in, you know. Just, like, if you look at the transitions between a lot of the sequences and a lot of, like, really heavy moving shots from, mm-hmm, like, a lot of physical object stuff that leads you into different scenes. And...
I
thought it was apparent in Cloud Atlas, that was in Bound, and even in The Matrix a lot.
I think of those shots, like, through the walls and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, the moving cameras, like, from different rooms into a different room, that kind of, yeah.
And they usually, you know, start on, like, whether it's, you know, somebody's face to an object, or like the phone to something, or a dollar bill. I think there's something in that they carry through The Matrix that you see. It's almost, you know, whether, you know, it might not be anything too new or specific to filmmaking, but it's something
they like. I'd have to rewatch some, like, that slave ship sequence to, because I wasn't paying attention to, like, you know, editing pattern or anything like
and
that, or how they
the
were.
The Neo Soul thing, I wouldn't say I knew that any of the other sequences stuck out to me as, oh yeah, the Wachowski brothers definitely directed this, or Tom Weicker definitely directed this.
Yeah,
I didn't know.
I was very curious of, because it's
I
rare.
I think you would have, if you had seen this movie without knowing who directed it, you would definitely know it was the Wachowski brothers.
But
just by the casting. Just by, what's his name?
Well, Hugo Weaving.
Yeah.
As
I mean,
heavy,
and sort of the stuff. Oh, you. I think you would absolutely know that it was Wachowski brothers.
You weren't able to tell which stories were Wachowski's versus...
No.
Because I'm like, how do you... It's so rare that two directors, and here it's three.
Yeah.
So in the credits, they split it up by storyline.
Yeah.
Wachowski's directed three, and the Twikers.
Yeah, did you notate, like, which ones were directed by which?
I didn't write those down, but there's no
way. I would
way
guess,
that,
well, first of all, the Neo Soul one had to be the Wachowskis.
Yeah.
And I would guess the other futuristic one
was the Wachowskis.
Was the Wachowskis also.
And then
the other futuristic one.
The one where Tom Hanks and Halle Berry speak in, like,
oh, the way. Okay. The one that's back to primitive hunters and gatherers.
I would actually guess then the composer sequence was them as well.
Because of sort of
just the filmmaking to me, you know, felt a certain
what were the other sequences then? So you have the composer, you have the present day Jim Broadbent.
Right, and I would say that was probably Tom Twyker, is my guess.
But that
was a questionable one for me. I was having, you know, if you say the cannibalistic, but to me, yeah, it's tough, because the cannibalistic one to me, then you have the Tom Hanks the Wachowski brothers' mark is more on this movie. Part of this is what's interesting is that Tom Twyker, I was thinking about it, like, yeah, he's got Run, Lola, Run. Can you name another movie the guy's
done? No. But, right. And let's be honest, like, how the movie came about is, yes, the Wachowski brothers asked him to direct a couple sequences. So even if, you know, he brought something to it, it's a little bit different than I'm directing this movie.
But, I mean, he's directing three of those.
Yeah, but it's so like... It's like directing a half. People directing a TV show don't as much influence as someone directing a movie.
You know,
it was interesting.
I was thinking about, you know, even back when this was still kind of before it came out, I saw How the West Was Won. Uh-huh. It had like a special screening at the Arclight, was showing it in Cinerama. They were showing the actual Cinerama print, like three-strip print. And that was a movie that was three or four directors... did, but it was really specific, like sequence, like there was no overlap between what they were doing. It was one per director's stuff, the next director, and then the third. Whereas this one, like the editing of the movie is such that
it's meant to be one thing.
This is a group directing.
They have to be
on
point
of
how a shot ends. And if it's going into another story, how that one's going
to
end. Because
at least
there's
a third sequence. That's not very Wachowski's, too.
The 70s sequence? Yeah, that wouldn't surprise...
I mean, it has,
I don't know, though.
The car going over the bridge, like, that whole shot, like, you know, in the car, underwater, it just...
there's stuff about it. That'd be interesting to look it up. We should... Maybe it's interesting, more interesting that we haven't...
Well, I think the bigger thing is that, and they've even said it about the movie, is... They didn't even like having to do that. That was required of them by
the
DGA.
Oh, really?
To say that this was directed by all three of these people, but these these sections were specific, you know?
Yeah.
And it was, and, you know...
Yeah, so it's maybe even a little inaccurate to even talk about it that way, because they could probably, all three of them, conceived of the sequences together.
Yeah, absolutely.
And came up with the shot list together and everything. So,
you couldn't have come up with the the transitions were such that they went to every different period from other periods that, like, those were planned before the shooting.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the fun aspects of this movie is, since you have these recognizable actors and they're playing multiple characters, it was fun just to, and a lot of times they'd be in heavy makeup.
Oh, yeah.
As a new character is introduced, trying to guess, like, who's behind that makeup. Tom Hanks is always Tom Hanks to me. He does not disappear like the other ones. I don't know.
Who disappeared to you that stood out? I mean, the people to me that
stood
out. For
the performance-wise, or just there's... I thought, like...
Jim Broadbent.
Jim Broadbent is really
good. I came
good
away thinking, this guy is unbelievable. You know?
And Ben Whishaw is probably...
Yeah. Who's he?
He's the young composer. And he was the guy who I came out thinking, that guy really... Yeah. Like, because I would put, like, after the Timothy Cavendish, that's my favorite sequence, my favorite, storyline of the movie. And I thought he just... I thought he holds it up, you know.
And then, for whatever reason... Hugh Grant is just kind of funny these heavily made up villainous roles.
Well, did you know he played one of the cannibals?
No.
He's totally unrecognizable. Yeah, like, no one could recognize him. It was at the end of the movie they show who played who.
Yeah,
and it was like,
Hugh Grant was
one of the cannibals?
That was one of the more fun parts of the movie is when, during the credits, they show each one playing six roles.
Okay, well,
Halle Berry does not disappear at all.
Well, we have to talk about the Korean woman showing up in the Pacific Islanders thing. Yeah. And, like, I mean, this is one of the reasons both why the movie kind of, like, as a whole, it's kind of never going to work, but why... I kind of loved the filmmakers for doing it, of just saying, like, there's no way you can make this movie and it be perfect, like, because you're having all these actors play these weird roles.
It's an experiment.
Right.
But in that way, I want it to be even more crazy. Like, it's this huge movie, but yet it felt in a way very mainstream. I wanted it to be more bonkers.
But it was pretty bonkers. This, I think what you're doing is you're asking for it to be the most crazy movie ever.
Well, it is bonkers. But the stories
themselves are so
in a different language. They speak in a different language.
I'm saying it's bonkers. And so, like, the storytelling and the thematic has to be pretty simple to do that.
Right, but you wanted them to be exploring some sort of more avant-garde, crazier ideas than, like, free yourself out of slavery.
No, I think the stories themselves, if you break them down as six short stories, these are all very cliched storylines.
Yes.
And that's not holding up to the ambition as a whole.
Right. Except the one that you guys were talking about that you liked.
Yeah,
that
the
one is, I mean, I wouldn't say it's cliched. It's that somewhat one, familiar, but there's some surreal.
Oh, no, there's a real surreal. His brother puts him in an old person's home that he doesn't even think he's checking in.
Hugo Weaving playing.
It's crazy.
I mean, that's when they're going for.
You know, it's One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, basically. Like, that's what the sort of, you know, and the cultural touchstone.
But they're twisting it around into this bizarro comedy.
Right, yeah.
While the other ones are played much more straight.
But here's, you know what's weird about that one.
Could you, in this, like, fractured storytelling, you know, postmodern world, wherever we live in, if you're making a movie with six different storylines, I mean, how are they in some way not going to be cliched in terms of storylines?
Well, how do you tell any story that's not cliche?
Right. I mean, that's what I'm saying.
It's not an easy task. I know it's not hard.
Yeah, I guess let them off the hook for it because they're doing so many other things that they are sort of like, we liked this book, we liked these stories.
Yeah.
And I would guess, you know, and I don't know this, not having read the book, I would guess they played up the cliches a bit more.
Yeah,
to try to make it more cohesive.
I mean, you're making an expensive movie. You have to appeal to people. But, like, can I say one thing about that storyline, though?
Which storyline?
The guy getting locked up in the mental institution. Is that I actually thought...
Senior home.
Oh, senior home. Yeah, whatever. But I actually thought that he was losing his mind midway through.
Yeah.
Like,
I interpreted it like,
oh, he's getting locked up because he's crazy.
Right.
But then that's what I liked is that, and the other stories didn't quite have that. They had, like, they had that cheat in the futuristic one where somehow the Neo Soul, where he sort of comes out of nowhere and, like, saves her, which made no sense, like, how that happened. They didn't explain it at all. But, so, like, narratively, there weren't that many, I guess I would say, big surprises. Like, especially the slave ship one, I was like, it was actually kind of a dull story, if you think about it. It was just...
Yeah, that was the...
Oh, did we already...
Oh, the surprise was that Hanks was poisoning the guy.
But we...
And
you kind of
know
knew
that the whole time?
You kind of knew that pretty early on, at least.
That one was missing a key element.
Yeah.
Something was off about that one the whole time. It had just such...
There needed to be a twist.
I mean, it was one of those where I'm like, yeah, maybe you should just make this five stories. Whenever that one came on screen.
I don't know. But whatever. I mean, I don't know. I didn't even think about which storyline I actually liked the best in a weird way until you guys brought it up.
Because I think the movie does play as much as it can as a seamless whole cutting back and forth that, like, while other movies that have, like, multiple storylines will often play, like, huge chunks and then cut back.
Just talking about it, I'm excited to, like, you know, that I'll watch parts of this again at some point. I mean, it's fun.
I probably
cause I
won't.
Am like excited hearing about it and talking about it.
I probably won't rewatch this movie, though. That's
I think I'll sit down from beginning to end.
Yeah.
But I'm excited to, like, be flipping around channels and come across it.
I didn't think they very much dealt with... I thought the whole movie was supposed to be about, like, reincarnation or, you know, souls moving over time or, I thought it was going to be something about that. I mean, why else do you do all this casting and with the little tattoo thing or birthmark or whatever? But I didn't think the movie at all even addressed that, and I don't know if that's in the book.
I don't think it addressed it directly, but I think it's sort of there inherently by doing it that way.
But that's the whole point, is, like, it's like one of those things where it's like they didn't handle what is native to the material, they didn't handle it in a way that made you think about these kind of things.
No,
like,
they just by the fact that some of the characters, it's not just the actors playing multiple parts, they're sort of the same character in different aspects of time. Or like Halle Berry somehow recognizing a piece of music. I felt they did do that sort of soul passing, if you want to. Yeah.
Well, see, I didn't, just what you said,
I didn't look into it that much. Yeah,
the what you said, how much more interesting would that movie be, actually, if you could actually pull that off, where
they are
the reincarnated souls of the actors that they played, but in different circumstances take on a different role. Yeah. That is way more interesting.
I think that's what they are going.
I wasn't even thinking, like, I was trying to, you know, jump ahead and, like, think it was an interesting thing when you realize that this is what's happening of, like, for instance, in the 70s story, like, we've already seen Tom Hanks in the present-day Timothy Cavendish, Jim Broadbent one. Mm-hmm. And so, like, I was trying to think, well, I know Tom Hanks has to die in this one because he has to get reborn and be at this certain age by the time that 2012 hits. And so, like, I, you know, was doing that in other places or trying to do it. It wasn't as obvious to me as it was in that one. But I was trying to think, like, I was even trying to place out the life-death cycles.
Oh, God, I didn't
even
think
different
about that.
Actors.
Is that an actual thing in the movie?
I think so, but I don't know for sure.
It sometimes was really clear that that's what they were trying to do. But then, yeah, you can point out certain roles, like Tom Hanks and Halle Berry seem to be consistently connected and the good people in each one. But then you can say, well, Tom Hanks in the pirate or the slave ship one throws that off. But beyond that, there's definitely a connection with him and Halle Berry and all the others.
Well, they have one look in the Timothy Cavendish one before he throws somebody off the roof.
But, I mean, so it's Tom Hanks and Halle Berry in the 1970s. They have, like, a connection in that one.
Yeah, was Halle Berry? Well, she played the wife of the grand, you know, the master composer, but she wasn't in the Pacific Islander one.
See, I don't think
they don't run through all of them,
reincarnation thing actually really comes to play out in any sort of cohesive way in the movie.
Yeah,
I think it was at some point brought up as an idea.
Tom Hanks and in the most future storyline, I mean, he's narrating the movie as an old man and he's married to Halle Berry. Mm-hmm. And you see, and you know, they fall in love during the hunter-gatherer future storyline, and you see that they've had a connection throughout all these different eras. I mean, when he's like around the campfire telling the story, I feel he's not just he's telling the story directly, but it's sort of like the overall story. Yeah. I mean, whether so, I did get a sense that this was that's what kind of the movie.
Well, I'm really interested. I mean, part of me wants to just read part of the book to see how the writer dealt with that. Whether the characters that we know from watching the movie are the Tom Hanks characters, where they all have the same first name, or whether he tells you through other means.
I don't think he does.
Really?
I just, from talking to some people who had read the book,
it's just implied, or
there's just
or the
a hint
Wachowskis
at,
decided, okay, these characters are going to be the reincarnation.
Big decision by the Wachowskis.
Yeah, that's a big decision.
And because, I do think there's hints that, like, oh, they have the birthmark and stuff or whatever, but I don't think it's character is this person. I don't think it's at all explicit. Because
it ends up being more just like, if it's not that, it's the obvious, you know, like a bigger thematic probably in the book is just written history, you know, that, because I know I even flipped through, I was in the bookstore this week and like opened up, I was just there for a moment and like opened up Cloud Atlas, because of course there's a ton of copies in the bookstore, and it opens with the Pacific Journals of whatever that guy's name is.
Oh, yeah.
And so that guy writes it, and then in the next story
and he writes
line,
it in the style of each era is what I've read. Like, so the first one is, like diary entries. Mm. And then with each story, his style of prose becomes what that style right. of writing
but,
was.
But I guess I'm just time. Saying there's always a so, textual yeah. thing, you know, that's connecting each storyline. The first one is the journal. The next one would be the piece of music, the Cloud Atlas sextet. The next one would be the investigative report that gets passed on. And then the next one would be the Timothy Cavendish
memoir.
And the next one would be, the last one would be the woman's recording of her speech.
Or the interrogation.
The recording of the interrogation?
Well, I don't know.
Right, but it's matter, probably, but that's what I mean, the interrogation, because she's recording it.
The whole frame of that storyline is that she's being interrogated
right.
about
but
the
but at
events.
The end, she is recording her speech to be disseminated after she's dead. You know, it is sort of the is her whole goal.
Yeah, right. That's
and so,
yeah.
And then the very last one is Tom Hanks telling us.
Yeah.
The story, right. like passing like on kids. An oral, yeah, yeah an oral kid, storytelling yeah. tradition. So I guess, and I would guess those elements are in the book. And so that, it's weird. That's probably a really big thematic in the book that gets a little
right.
bit left behind in the movie because
yeah, it's of a other different
means.
Point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, you're yeah. watching the events as they unfold.
And that's probably partly like some of the success of the book was this writer being able to capture different literary styles.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. Yeah. Although I have to say, I did not want to read the book.
No.
Not, it's not on my list.
No,
right.
I was curious right. about that. The movie did not make me
no,
want
I'm,
to read
I'm,
the book.
Exactly. Like you said, I'm curious to read a little, but yeah. I don't know if I want to read the whole book.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And so sort of, Andy, you seem like the biggest fan.
Probably. Yeah, I would. I mean, it seemed like it talking amongst us, yeah. you know. I'd probably, you know, it's one of these tough movies where, yeah, there's not that many people, like friends, family that I would tell, oh, yeah, go see this, you're going to love it, because they're not, you know. But I know I liked a lot of it, and, you know, there's a certain kind of movie go that's going to enjoy it. But I would, like, highly recommend it to people to, like, are you looking for something different?
Yeah.
Are you kind of... Have you hit a point where you maybe are a little tired of the, you know, the staleness of movie storytelling, and this is worth going to see?
I think it was a little bit of a refreshing kind of feeling that these guys who were, you know, top filmmakers,
and
A-list
woman.
Film, yeah, and woman, decide to take on
Post-woman.
Something. They decide to take on something that is. Out there. That's what I think is somewhat refreshing about it, like, personally, even though, you know, not, I wouldn't say a grand success or anything like that.
Yeah.
I'll take this over, you know, I don't know, a sequel or a comic book movie, you know, any day, that kind of thing, personally.
Have you bought the Cloud Atlas sextet?
No.
Yeah.
The piece of music was really nice. That
it was
one
surprising
of the better,
that they
yeah.
were able, because it's such, like, you are kind of, you know, you're telling people this guy has created a masterpiece. That, yeah, and they're
to
able
deliver.
To make the music.
I was curious.
Enough.
So
right.
we're pretty sure that was written for the movie. It's not some classical piece.
I don't know.
I feel it's
I would guess
a real
it
challenge
is.
That if
right.
you're setting up that a music is masterpiece.
Yeah.
The music has to be
right.
good.
Yeah, it's tough.
I would have thought it was a thing, yeah.
You would have thought it was a different composer that
yeah,
was
it was
classical
a, it was a
piece.
Piece of music that actually existed that they were sort of fictionalizing its creation.
Well, I would guess a composer did it, but that they were given very they were told to mimic a certain other kind of composer, like I would probably say Shostakovich, like yeah, you know, do something in the style of this guy, this piece, then they chose a piece.
I'm impressed you pulled that composer. Yeah. You must have done some research.
No, I didn't do any research.
Shostakovich just jumps out of your head with sitting around.
Phil, I've seen a lot of opera in my day in classical music. I don't know. You know,
maybe we should make this an opera podcast and you can teach me and Greg one or two things.
Yeah, I'd like to learn.
Yeah.
Well, Any other movies?
To talk about?
Movies we've seen recently, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I've seen Bond. I've seen the new James Bond.
Yeah, I know we've all seen Bond. So it's sort of like, are we going to talk about Bond now, or are we going to talk about some smaller movies before? That would be the question.
I don't have anything else to talk about.
Yeah. We can talk about Bond now.
Phil, what do you think of Bond?
I thought it was pretty boring.
Boring.
I want to put out... It had an incredible look to it. The cinematography was the best thing about the movie. And Javier Bardem is awesome, but he's got really nothing. He's got an incredible introductory moment. And then
Before we get into it, let everyone say where they are on it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah, I did not like it.
Yeah. Okay, we got that. Andy.
Oh, I liked it. You know, fun night at the movies is how I'd put it. Like, you know, that's sort of all I would give it. But, yeah, I liked it.
Okay. And I think I liked it probably more than both you guys. I was surprised at how much I liked it. I think my expectations were very low. And I was like, yeah, I thought it was pretty good. But anyway, so let's go into what you were saying about...
I think they write themselves... I mean, the movie has... Nowhere to go. They set up an interesting conflict where this villain that's off screen that you haven't met that will become Javier Bardem is creating this terrorist.
Yeah, he's the Joker.
Yeah.
He's creating chaos.
For revenge.
Uh-huh.
But that's not what the movie becomes about at all. You meet him about halfway through the movie and he has a great introduction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He awesome. Has this walk-on speech all in one take.
How many takes do you think they had to do with that?
One.
No, I would. Yeah, and
the magic's there.
That, yeah.
I would guess Javier Bardem doesn't need that many takes to do that.
It was awesome.
So he has a great introduction, and I'm like, oh, this feels special. There's some other stuff before that I want to get back to, but while I'm
all the way
Javier
through
Bardem,
his arrest is pretty fin. I would call that as a sequence.
Who's
is
arrest?
Pretty fin. Javier Bardem's, because it is. Like,
I even
like
the arrest.
Sequence.
Yeah.
Well, no, I'm saying all the way through the helicopters coming to the island. Like,
because
it's only 10 or 15 minutes.
No, that's not long at all. Yeah,
but it's it was my favorite part of the movie.
Overall, I can word it this way. I thought the plotting and pacing was really off in this movie. Just. Way before Javier Bardem, there are some sequences that don't have much to do, that are just there and don't really do much. Like, there's a really interesting visual sequence where Bond is in Tokyo and he's going after
Shanghai.
Is it Shanghai?
Shanghai and Macau.
It was. It just had this really interesting
in the
lit.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
View.
Yeah.
Like the lighting is crazy, but I felt it was there.
Yeah, it was like
for
the
lighting.
It was the end of Collateral.
And
basically,
and I'm like, Bond does this
long sequence.
Bond is
in that. I mean, that was what was surprising. It was like, wow, this is really going on a long time.
And it doesn't lead to anything. I mean,
well, it leads to the woman.
Well,
and
it
leads
but what
to
is she
the,
even
it's
doing?
It's very
it's
subtle,
so
but
weird.
It gives him he gives him the clue to go to Macau and get
so
tied into Harvey. Did you notice that it was weird? They didn't put a super over Macau, like, because you know he's going on that weird little standing boat thing.
Yeah. One awesome visual though.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
But it was sort of like, oh, we're still in Shanghai, and then you get in there and you sort of the viewer has to put together, oh, we're in Macau now.
Oh, yeah. Do they normally do, like...
Well, they were doing supers over everything.
Oh, they did?
And it was an unusual one to skip.
So you follow this assassin. that's one scene that I'm just like, wow, visually, this is impressive.
Here's a question I would have for you guys.
I'd say the same thing about the Komodo dragon scene. This is in a public place.
What? You're disputing, like, them having a Komodo dragon in a Bond movie?
No.
You're talking about
a
franchise that, you know, typically will person will be
this is
by
in,
sharks,
like, a public
piranhas.
Lounge.
Huh?
Right, but they're not in a villain's layer. They're in a public lounge.
They're in, well, some, they're in some CD, weird gambling, yeah, crazy place.
I thought it was
gangster casino.
Well, so you were a fan of the Komodo dragons just dragging people
which
no one reacting.
Which Bond movie is it where the entire lake is a fake lake and the whole lake moves away and it's like a rocket launching?
The villain's lair, most of the time in Bond movies, yeah, you get drawn in the villain's lair and there's piranhas.
This is what, you know, is the, I would say is like, you know, a problematic point with these Bond movies is they are tipping the hat to old Bond movies, but they clearly are in some way not wanting to be of that world. They want to be of a world of a Bourne, of the Bourne films.
Yes, and this is
I would say I do agree with Phil that some of this stuff just feels more out of place than in old Bond movies where that was the tone, and this one is trying to juggle different tones.
Look, absolutely.
I don't think it juggles tones successfully.
Well, look, I absolutely think they are trying to take Bond in a different... Look, it's the Daniel Craig Bond has been a sort of like... I haven't liked it all that much. It's been serious. It's been like Freudian, you know, it's like all this sort of like, oh, why was Bond hurt in that other one, Casino Royale? And, you know, it's hard boiled Bond. It's not as humorous. It's not as fun. I mean, they went far in this one to be like, no, he's not drinking martinis. And no, he's not, you know, having like, I mean,
well,
I guess he
did have a martini in Macau.
He did. I guess they did give him a martini, but he was drinking whiskey,
right,
in most of the movie. And so, yeah, they're trying to do something different.
Well,
but
it was almost that he was discovering martini. They kept letting it sort of.
They keep wanting this
to be origin stuff a little bit. I think.
Yeah. Well, I would just say this: that
well,
of
that's
the
not
Daniel
why
Craig
Greg would like the movie or not.
Right.
I mean,
no, I would say this: of the Daniel Craig Bond movies, this I thought was by far the best one, and I was surprised at how much I liked it. And I actually thought they were doing a lot of interesting thematic stuff in this one that I agree gets away from like the campy kind of Bond and was trying to do like sort of like looking at what the world is in a post-Cold War world. Like, yeah, there's no Soviets, there's no Spectre, there's no sort of these clowny villains, but this was like, you know, M has her speech at some point about what the world is now, that the enemy could be anybody. It's like, can be the people next door. And that's a very sort of contemporary post 9/11 idea. Right. And not only that, they were looking at youth versus age throughout the whole movie. That was like a huge thematic. They're also looking at the technical, computer.
Even to pull it into like Cloud Atlas a little bit, we have Ben Whishaw, who I liked in the Bond movie a lot too. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was it reminded me a little bit. I don't want to like overstep the bounds here because it's only slight. But he has this speech, the Q, he's playing Q, the really young gizmo addict.
Right.
And he gives this speech to Bond about how Bond is the old world.
And he
can get so much more done before he wakes up just
on the computer.
You know, on the computer. Yeah. And he essentially, you know, kind of states like what the state of the world is, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But I also think in a weird way, he is stating why it is so difficult for these filmmakers to go make a Bond movie now, because he is saying, yeah, you know, the Bond movies don't like, we can't do this stupid movie in the present tense in terms of stupid, of like stupid villainy, because that's really what old Bond movies were. Is the villains were a little bit,
yeah, they're megalomaniac, brilliant, like crazy geniuses.
And so they're sort of saying, they're sort of tipping their hat of saying, you know, it doesn't make sense to make a Bond movie now, but we're going to try our best. And it reminded me a little bit of the Looper speech of, you know, all this, you know, that we talked about, the Bruce Willis thing.
Don't think about it too much.
Don't think about all the time travel stuff because it's going to ruin your enjoyment of the movie. And I did have that sense of, okay.
But then they went off and did it. The whole point of that speech and the movie, the point of view is not that, oh, we're just in this computer
but my argument is that the third act of it is tacked on.
As a storyteller, Greg, you can't possibly...
It's preposterous and doesn't make any sense. I absolutely agree.
It's tacked on. It's a fourth act.
They've got nowhere to go.
Absolutely. I still enjoyed watching it. It was
even,
fun.
Right. Even that.
The straw dogs? You mean the straw bomb goes straw
but
dogs?
It's a whole.
Yeah, I liked it.
It's 45 minutes.
I enjoyed watching it. I liked it.
But at the same time,
it was
fun to watch. I didn't have any, like.
What am I going to say?
I didn't have, like.
I'm like, oh, they're.
A suspense to it. I didn't have a suspense to it.
Like,
even when Judi Dench, you know, spoiler, is killed in it, it didn't matter to me. Like, it didn't make any difference whether she lived or died.
I did think, we're going to spoil
I rolled my eyes when Albert Finney comes on as an old crotchety...
But I liked him.
And I'm like, oh my God. Because the movie had nowhere to go. It was a different movie.
Yeah.
They wrote themselves... What they set up in the first act had nothing to do with the rest of the movie after a while. And then Javier Bardem is just completely about... revenge, and it became much smaller than him laying out these terrorists.
Well, and it was just
storyline, which was to me much more interesting.
Bond is going to take this woman out to this thing, and then in literally an army of 30 men
we're just
going to
have
come
a cliched ambush.
I was expecting just Javier Bardem to come, and then he comes with 30 men, and I'm like, that was kind of stupid.
I thought it was going to be incredible if they were going to end the movie in that courtroom scene. Remember when he attacks and she's giving that speech?
That's what I thought was going
to end. And it was I thought that was a very cool sort of intercutting where she's giving that speech and he's coming for her. And it's all this like close quarters gunfighting in there. I was like, oh man, that was awesome. And I thought the movie was going to sort of end there or have maybe one little thing afterwards. And then they tack on this thing and I'm like, oh boy, God, this movie, they're doing this thing that the Avengers does, that Mission Impossible does, that Girl with the Dragon Tattoo does. All these big movies, they tack on that's essentially this, like, overly long third or fourth act, whatever you want to call it, depending on how you want to think about it. And so I was with you guys. But then, visually, and they go to Skyfall, and they're back in this, like, sort of raw, old Scottish thing. And I actually thought the theme sort of came out again. It was sort of this idea that Bond had to go back to ground. He had to go get, like, raw and nasty again.
Come on.
And I liked it.
You know, I guess...
What does he have to do there? You're saying, like, he's back to his roots, but...
He goes home. He goes to where he's from. What are you talking about? He's back to... That is exactly where he is.
I mean, it just becomes a shootout.
It becomes Straw Dogs.
Yeah, I guess... But Straw Dogs, they're using, primitive weapons. It's not all guns.
To me, you know, and it's... Yeah, I think it does kind of relate to our discussion of Cloud Atlas. To me, that is an idea. Like, you know, they had an idea that they wanted to see out. And so they tried it. And to me, I was more respectful of the Cloud Atlas. Like, let's see if this idea works in the Bond. And I do think it's interesting, like, just to bring this up with the Avengers and all these other big movies, of, like, the cost of the movies has gone up to make these so much. I do think it... in some ways makes sense that they're shooting these longer movies.
Give you more bang for your buck.
Right, like, they have the actors under a certain contract, they have the crew. Like, to go out and shoot an extra sequence is probably a couple million dollars more versus, you know, and it is almost worth it for them to do it.
Yeah. Are there other movies we should talk about?
Yeah, let's
talk
about it. Too much Bond.
Anything else they've seen? Yeah, we talked about Bond for a long time.
Too much Bond.
Some foreign films?
Yes, I would like... I saw...
Oh, yeah, I don't want to hear Phil talking about
I just wanted to set it up a little bit. I saw Holy Motors, which is a French film, and it played Cannes, and I saw it at the AFI Fest, and so they had the director there, this Léos Carrat, came to introduce the film, and he was sort of like a boy wonder director when he was 23, and, like, he's become, like, this l'enfant terrible in... France, and he makes a movie, like, very seldomly. So he comes out and introduces the film, and he's wearing sunglasses and has this mustache, and he is, like, a perfect French director image. And he comes out, picks up the microphone, and goes, "I hope you like my movie or not," and drops the mic and walks off stage. And it was such a good introduction for what this movie is. And Holy Motors, I don't want to ruin it for Andy.
Yeah,
but it is a perfect companion piece for Cosmopolis, which we've talked about earlier. It's a guy driving over the course of a day in a limousine.
For me, for I know enough about it where that doesn't, you know.
And
yeah,
well, so we will talk about it in a future
podcast? Well, I'm definitely going to see, you know, because it's playing in L.A. very briefly, but I'm going to see it at one of its, either at the New Art this week or the Cine Family next week.
I mean, is it worth seeing?
Yes, it is worth seeing. It is a fun time at the cinema and is talking about the cinema at the same time.
It's where I saw a movie at the AFI.
Kind of wild.
At the AFI Fest, too, just to, you know, beyond our foreign language. I saw this movie called Beyond the Hills.
Oh, which one was that?
It's a director named Christian Mungu, or, you know, M-U-N-G-U, a Romanian director. He did the movie, you know, it might have been nominated for Best Oscar. It was a big foreign film release, maybe three or four years ago. 4 months, 3 weeks, 2 days.
Oh, yeah.
Or, you know, 1 hour. Kind of like, you know, Cold War abortion movie, essentially. And yeah, it was one of the tougher movie viewings I've had in a while. Just like art. I mean, every shot, every scene in the movie is there's no cuts. There's one shot and, you know, and you felt it. I mean, the movie was about like these two orphan friends, lesbian lovers who are reunited. One of them has gone on to this religious sect, you know, very strict Orthodox, some sort of Christian sect in Romania, as like a kind of a nun. And her friend comes to visit her, and they're lovers, and her friend wants her to leave, and she, you know, the girl who's a nun's not going to leave, and it's this, like, you know, push and pull, and it just kind of goes nowhere. It just made me, and in the movie, I don't know if it's gotten a great critical response, but it just felt like this.
For the record, I just fell asleep.
Yeah.
Sorry, fell asleep.
Solemn tone in this room. Andy has this expression.
I didn't hear
of telling
that. I thought I was having a dream.
A death in a slow take.
Oh yeah, no, and that was my experience watching this movie. I mean, I don't know. I probably shouldn't try to explain it too much, other than I guess my larger point was it felt akin to a lot of international festival cinema, specifically that there's a lot of this cinema that feels enamored with one take, like not cutting, and, you know, slow, realistic performance. And I guess, you know, this to me was kind of like, you know, give me something else. I mean, there's good versions of that, but like,
give me Cloud Atlas.
Well, but, you know, movies that shouldn't be vaunted end up getting vaunted because they're trading on the style of better movies that have come before.
Who's vaunting this, though? You know,
well, the, you know, international festival community, whatever you want to say.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, that's who it is. Yeah.
Holy Motors.
Yeah, Holy Motors.
I look forward.
Did you see anything else? I mean, or Greg? I mean,
I don't
Greg.
Think in the theater. I have, but I've been instructed not to speak of the movie.
Yes. Well, we save Spielberg for later.
Are we talking about video movies?
We can talk about they jumped out.
I saw bad. I saw Arthur, which
I
have never seen.
I really liked Arthur. I watched it maybe last year.
I thought it was surprising. I liked it. I didn't.
It was
love
very
it.
Popular when it came out.
I know, but it's it's really influential into a lot of movies, and I didn't see
like,
the remake.
Like what movies are?
Oh, I think out. Like all the Adam Sandler and Chris Farley sort of man-child movies.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of how I interpreted it. But I was surprised. It made me think of Bad News Bears, because you watch this movie, you watch the old Bad News Bears, and it's like these sort of drunken, rambunctious, like wild movies.
Yeah, Arthur's one of the most drunken alcoholic
it's
movies.
It's just a drunk. It's like I'm just making a movie. Yeah, I mean, it's just a drunk. Yeah. That's what the movie is.
I mean, it might be more the drunk than Leaving Las Vegas, except it's a comedy.
Yeah. And it's like, I didn't see the remake, so I shouldn't criticize the remake before having seen it. But these, like, I don't understand why Like, if I saw this, I did just see this movie, and I were a studio executive or something, I would never be like, oh yeah, let's remake this.
Yeah, because they can't remake it, because they need to scrub everything that makes the original a success.
I mean, yeah,
they can't,
it's like...
They can't put that out under a 20th Century Fox
Banner. I mean, the only way you can make... basically, you just... Dudley Moore's like, I think I want to play a drunk guy for the movie. Okay, yeah, that's let's do that. And he's so on fire that it's, like, worth... watching. And yeah, I mean,
Dudley Moore
is
this
woman that, like, what are the circumstances? I can't even remember.
Oh,
he's marrying some woman. Like, why is he marrying that woman?
He's engaged to marry some rich woman, and he's
got some family set up.
Some family set up, and she's in love with him.
Oh, yeah,
and he's really, you know, wealthy. And basically, the whole movie, he doesn't want to marry her, and his family's like, no, we're going to disinherit you. You're not going to get $750 million.
Yeah.
And it's very funny because he's like, okay, yeah, I'll marry her. Yeah, it's cool. I'm not. He's used to the life. You know, he's not, he doesn't want to. Right. But he bumps into Liza Minnelli, who's at a store.
Ooh, kind of an annoying character, but kind of winning at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny because she's not attractive.
Oh, no.
And he's not attractive. And it's like, I don't know. And he just likes her. And you get why he likes her, though, just because she's different. And she's like stealing a tie and whatever. Yeah. And you know, and then he really the movie is the relationship between him and his like butler guy, this old British guy who's sort of his like surrogate father. But it's, I don't know, it's just funny. It's weird. But I enjoyed watching that. And then I saw Julie and Julio, which was unwatchable. I would not recommend that.
You mean you didn't like the Meryl Streep, Stanley Tucci stuff either?
No.
Oh.
Yeah, I liked... No. I liked that.
I was just bored.
The Amy Adams stuff was cringeworthy to me, but the Meryl Streep and Stanley Tucci stuff was made that movie, like, I still think fondly of it.
I haven't seen that before? You know, do I need more Meryl Streep, Stanley Tucci? Like, it's like watching the Spurs play basketball. Yeah. It's like, yeah, fine. Okay. I mean, fine. Yeah, it's fine. You're so talented. You guys are so talented. Let's just watch you dress up and, you know, say your lines.
What were you thinking, Julie and Julio? You seem to have such a distaste for it. I wonder what you were thinking the movie was going to be, because I definitely think...
I just wanted to watch it to be aware of the...
Amy Adams definitely suffers in it. She seems like kind of a whiner, and she...
Yeah, it's terrible.
Playing counterpart to Meryl Streep is...
Well, she's kind
of what was I thinking? Good question. That is a good question. Well, maybe I wasn't thinking
clearly. Well, you were here just to go off, just to go off Meryl Streep and Amy Adams, who I know you're fond of, Phil. I would like, you know, I just want to report back to you another, you know, actress that you're kind of concerned for. I watched a recent Lizzie Kaplan movie on VOD
I think she's done. The Bachelorette was so bad, I don't care to see her again.
Yeah, I saw Save the Date. That was, it's like a pre-theatrical VOD. And yeah, it's not going to...
Didn't look good.
It's not going to make you change your opinion on Lizzie Kaplan, unfortunately. But at the same time, you know, it's tough for me to criticize him. The movie is so small and you know, has moments that I kind of, you know, I don't want to like throw it under too much, but... it's not a Lizzie Kaplan performance.
Lizzie Kaplan, I'm now reevaluating her. She is playing a version of herself in Party Down, and that's what she can do.
Well, I mostly think I liked her in her like three episodes.
You liked her
arc
naked
in True Blood.
You like seeing her naked on television.
Right.
I want to hear more about Beyond the Hills. All right. Sounds good.
All right, good night. They pushed it closer. Looking.